Blog Talk Radio.
This is Monica Leal welcoming you to the LL Research radio program In the Now with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty. Today is Friday, August 24th, 2012. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. Jim McCarty is Carla Ruckert's husband, the scribe for the Raw Contact, and the president of LL Research. Please visit the websites llresearch.org, home to over 1,500 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, and more. And the community website, bringforth.org, that's bring, the number four, th.org, featuring forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. I'll be asking Carla and Jim questions that come from you. If you'd like to ask a question live on the air, call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294, or you can join the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Monica Leal, and I'm talking with Carla L. Ruckert and Jim McCarty of LL Research. Hi, Carla and Jim, are you with us?
We are.
We're here.
Okay, well, I guess you're pretty excited getting ready for the big bash next weekend.
We sure are. We're bracing ourselves, really, because it's quite an inundation to have 36 people in the house. It's, you know, it's a small house. It's 23-some hundred square feet. And somehow or another we manage. We have the meetings in a great big canopy in the backyard behind the garage where the garden used to be. Then we discovered that the black walnuts that grow along a row there at our property line were making the ground impossible to use. I didn't know that, but black walnuts leaves are...
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, you can't grow other stuff near them.
Right. So we rededicated the space for our homecomings, and Jim made a living centerpiece, which sometimes we add crystals to and stuff like that, but it's mostly what kind of flowers did you plant this year in addition to the great big chrysanthemum center?
Oh, let's see. I've got some impatiens, some geraniums, some begonia, and some marigolds.
Going to be pretty. I haven't been out there to see it because it's very difficult for me to walk around right now. I'm kind of hooked to a leash, and the leash doesn't want to go anywhere. So I'm pretty much here, and that's a fine place to be. But we are soon to be inundated. I'm talking about, whew, I think we have 5 volunteers that are coming early to scrub up the house and cook our feast for Friday night, and the things for snacks and lunch and breakfast, and we eat out during the weekend. We couldn't produce food for 36 people with just the stuff we have on hand. We wouldn't have any place to put it, but we do have one great big feast. So all 5 volunteers are going to be here Tuesday, and here we go. It's
all right. Sounds like fun.
It just starts cooking, and the vibration just winds and winds. It's a wonderful thing. Wonderful. I look forward to it so much.
Okay. So, everyone, we will not be having a show next Friday, the 31st? Yeah.
Yes.
Because of homecoming weekend. So we'll be back on the 7th, September 7th, and we'll hear all about it. So for now, I'm going to go ahead and go to our opening riff, And this, what session is this? It's April 22nd, but who is this from, Carla?
It's Kuo.
Okay, Kuo. Uh-huh. From April 22nd, 2007. There's a very specific difference between catalyst with which you are not finished and catalyst which you have balanced. When you remember a piece of catalyst and experience something sad or something said to you, and it puts you back into an emotional state that corresponds with the emotion that you felt at the time of the initial incident of receiving catalyst, then you have not yet concluded your work upon balancing that particular kind of energy expenditure. When instead you recall the instant or the remembrance of that experience comes to you and you do not have a feeling of being there, but only of acknowledging the presence of that lesson, then you are probably complete in your dealings with that catalyst. So it is a matter of observing where your triggers are, and when you are triggered, looking carefully at the thoughts that arise and the feelings that come with those thoughts. What you are doing is a kind of prospecting. You are looking for the gold in the ore of your personal, emotional, psychic, and mental mind. The joy of this kind of work is that you find gold at the heart of each learned lesson, and it is a lesson that is, shall we say, a heavenly treasure, a treasure of the soul. It is not something that has any value at all in the outer world. All of its value is within that world in which you are a citizen of eternity and a member of the Godhead principle.
Thank you, Monica. I picked this one because I think it's so important to understand the importance of our thoughts. We often delimit our attention to ourselves and fill our minds instead completely with the chores of the day, which is okay if you are also making note of those things that moved you for the positive or for the negative during that day, so that you have them accessible to you when you come to the evening hour and can sit and contemplate that day and what has happened, not in the sense of what you got done or anything like that, but what moved you from your normal setting of vibration for the good or for the ill. And as you do that, you are mining. You are going deep down into your mind and knowing yourself better and better as you see what it is that can move you, what it is that is still unhealed in you. Jim, would you mind talking about the balancing meditation? Because I'm a lot more wordy than you are, and it can become wordy. So I call on your terseness, please.
Okay. The basic idea is that all experiences that can ever be had are the Creator knowing itself. And if we see any experience as being other than that, then we can use that movement away, that distortion that we experience, as a means of moving closer to the Creator. So at the end of the day, in the meditative state, we can use our emotions as a kind of barometer to let us know whether we have had any experiences during that preceding day that were not perceived as the Creator knowing itself. If we had difficulty, or even an experience of great joy, either way, if we move any distance away from simple, all-compassionate love for the experience and everyone in it, then we have an indication that there's something we can work on. There's an area to be mined. There's some gold there that will help us to grow closer to the Creator. And what Ra suggested in the balancing process was that in the meditative state, we relive whatever experience moved us away from our center of all-compassionate love and experience it once again. But this time, we also, say we had some impatience or irritation or anger with somebody else, anybody else, doesn't really matter who the person is. Then we once again experience that irritation, that anger, and we allow it to become as large as it will become, or as large as we can experience it in our consciousness, in our mind, while we're meditating. Then once we've allowed that to become ridiculously large and overblown and out of proportion, then there seems to be the natural function within our beings for the polar opposite to begin to appear within our consciousness, so that understanding or love or acceptance begins to grow. And we allow that to grow until it is equal in balance to the first emotion, the anger, the irritation. And once both of those are equalized in our consciousness while we're meditating, then we accept the anger, we accept the love, and we accept ourselves as being whole and perfect. So as we continue to do this through a period of time, it may take months, it may take years, depending on how strong the emotion is, then we become more and more balanced. And usually, for each seeker, there are only a handful, five, six types of program catalysts that we have put in our incarnations before the incarnation to help us do this whole balancing process that each of us has. So it's something that does have a limit to it, although it might take a while to get to the balanced acceptance of the emotions and ourselves as being the creator, knowing itself.
Yeah. You can see how that could get ridiculously long if I went on for too long with it. Okay, that's the basic idea. And what are we doing here? Well, in a way, this exercise shows us what Ra valued in terms of two things, I think, that I would relate it to, psychology and magic, the ritual magic. In both distortions, shall we say, you are attempting to get to know yourself better. So if you have therapy going on, the therapist is likely to say, you know, and what happened this week, and then you tell, you know, what bothered you or what, you know, turned you on, and the therapist will go, well, how did that make you feel, and, you know, start probing into your feelings and your psyche and how you reacted, and really bringing it up to you, dusting it off so that you can see it without seeing anything else. And at that point, you are increasingly able to chisel away, shall we say, those things that don't actually belong, and value those little gems of buried pain, bring them up into the sunlight of consciousness, and work on balancing them so that you not only know yourself, but you begin to accept yourself. This is so important in psychology, and is really the goal of therapy in general, is for you to get to know yourself better so that you are able to compensate for any difficulties and become I guess a normal human being. I think that's very weak words, but become a person that is increasingly able to deal with his life, his experiences, his limitations, and so forth. Magic also asks you to become very stringently aware of who you are. What is it that you believe? Why did this hurt you? And look at it through that lens of how may I create within myself the magical personality that I need to, in Ra's terminology, reach the gateway to intelligent infinity so that I can access those wonderful menu choices, shall we say, of healing and prayer, and contemplation and meditation, and mysticism, journaling, dreams, all those things that are basically work in consciousness and having nothing to do whatsoever with what your work is or what your situation is in terms of age or sexuality or what. You are at that level working as a soul. And you do yourself a tremendous favor when you respect yourself and realize what a magical person you truly are. Now, I'm not saying that you get to the point where you carry your magical personality around all the time. That would be not a good thing. As Tony DiNozzo says on NCIS, that would be wrong. But you want to be able to call on the magical personality when you are attempting to access the gateway to intelligent infinity. So these two are seemingly far apart in what kind of people use therapy or what kind of people would work on in ceremonial magic. We don't have a lot of people working on ceremonial magic, but there are always a few. There are always a faithful few that are holding the light and on purpose and very consciously knowing that this has gone on since the beginning of man's experience upon earth and that it shall go on as long as we choose to become magical in our personality.
Can you explain why it would? You said it wouldn't be good to have your magical personality all the time.
Yes. When you're carrying the magical personality, you are very focused and you have that magical personality very consciously assumed. You can, if you have gone to the extent or the extreme of getting a robe and getting, you know, a knife and getting the various accoutrements of Western magic, you would don the robe and don the ring and so forth. And then the Ra said, well, you don't really have to do that if you have some way of suggesting to yourself that now you are putting on the magical personality. Then when your work is over, whether it is contemplation or whether it is doing a ritual of some kind, you then very deliberately and consciously remove the robe, whether it's a real robe or whether you take it off in your imagination. I turn a ring around before I start to channel or before I do the ritual of the lesser pentagram. Jim uses the donning on of the robe, but the reason that you can't carry this all the time is that you would not be able to. You would not be able to keep yourself at that level of true authenticity of self. You can't deal with the world and all of its 10,000 things in an effectual way if you are focused into the magical personality. It would be like trying to sleep all the time. Or what, Jim, can you think of a good example?
Well, it's hard to hold the focus that you need to do the magical working constantly. If you had the magical personality with you throughout the day, your focus would waver like the radio dial, and you'd be liable to pick up other stations that might not be helpful to you. And some of them could even be deleterious. So it's a matter of being able to maintain that focus. And it's something that is difficult enough to do during the time of the magical working that you really wouldn't want to tax yourself too far to try to keep that focus when you're moving into the worldly and mundane energies that are part of all of our daily round of activities, it would be expecting too much and opening yourself to difficulties to try to do that.
Yes, and where this one example that brings these two paths together is the Holy Communion of churches that offer Holy Communion as Jesus suggested at his Last Supper. The priest, if you'll listen to what he's saying at the altar, is donning the magical personality, is asking Jesus the Christ to come into the wine, to come into the wafer of bread, and live there. And, you know, that is a living entity of Jesus the Christ's vibration. And during that, we come up to the altar rail, we kneel before this wonderful place where Christ has been called, and we receive the blood, the body of Christ. And as it comes into our body and merges with our body, we have that ability to become the Christed ones that he intended us to. And after the ritual is done and there are no more people to feed with this wonderful vibration, the priest very deliberately finishes up the wine or grape juice, whatever's been poured out and blessed, so that there's nothing left over. Great respect is given to this, and it involves just, you know, stuffing wafers in your mouth sometimes if you've put too many out, drinking some wine or grape juice if you've guessed wrongly about how much you need. So that is the equivalent of putting away. And, of course, the priest does wear robes, and at least in our church he wears robes. So I think the Episcopal and the Catholic churches are probably more akin to the true magical ritual than Protestants, because there is this acceptance of the accoutrement, the robe, what do you call that thing that you wear around the neck? There's a name for all of these things. There are certain hats that some of the holy ones wear, and you know, there's every effort made by the priest to become worthy to call upon Jesus the Christ. And then, of course, at the end, he takes the robe off and becomes less of an absolutely focused and concentrated priest and more of a guy or a woman, you know, who has to deal with the mundane issues of church. Do we have to tuck point the stones that the church building has because it's an old church, or are we concerned about attendance, or do we need to find a new Sunday school teacher, or blah, blah, blah. It goes on. You know, every vocation has its difficulties in the lower chakras, naturally. If the priest is the kind of a guy that stays back in his office and stays in the study mode and, you know, so forth, he's probably not going to be appreciated as much as the guy who comes out into the sacristy and helps with the food ministry or the clothing ministry or carries somebody to the bus station. You know, the place where I went to church until about 10 years ago was right in the middle of downtown, and it was not at all unusual to see a homeless person sleeping in the grass by the church, because the eaves of the church offered some little protection, and there was always a knock on the church door, people looking for food, looking for money for a bus ride, looking for this and that. So, you know, had to move. I think that generally people appreciate the priest that can go help carry the groceries more than they might appreciate the priest that tries to stay very focused in his work. So, is there anything to add? Monica, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't, but that seems to flow right into our next question, actually, which is from the 59 sound. And this person asks, I'd like to hear some of Carla's personal experiences within the church. I'm specifically interested in her interactions with Christians who are, for want of a better term, King James Bible believers. You know, the type that are rigid dogmatists who, even though they might have the best intentions, tend to exclude, label, and shun people who don't believe everything in the Bible is the infallible Word of God and salvation is through Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. I'd really like to know how people like this have responded to Carla's communication with Ra, the Law of One, beliefs she might hold, and practices she has involved herself with that are not generally accepted by mainstream Christianity. I'm interested in both positive and negative reactions. I'm back in the USA, again in East Texas, Baptist country, and can see myself at some point in the future being challenged or excluded from certain circles on account of my less than fundamental Christian beliefs. Even though I feel I'm well equipped to deal with this, should it eventuate, it would still be helpful to hear from someone who may have been through it already. I feel it might be relevant to mention I was raised Catholic and do consider myself a Christian. It's not like I cannot understand and accept these types of people. It's that some of them will struggle to understand and accept me. This is from the 59 sound.
Okay. Let's see. First of all, let me give you the positive, because there is an amazing thing that goes on with me, and that is that when I started channeling in 74, I had collected maybe a month or 6 weeks worth of channeling. I went to my bishop because I knew him very, very well. In a previous radio station show, I talked about how one time at church camp, I was the only one that came to his evening offering of inquiry. And I was deeply troubled because I couldn't take the dogma, and I said that I just couldn't believe in Jesus, in the virgin birth. And I didn't see any point in it. And he said, you know, I've always had trouble with that myself, which made me, you know, just drop my jaw. And I said, how do you say the creed? And he said, oh, in hope that one day, probably not in this incarnation, I will come to understand why we're going through this. He said, I have no idea why I'm going through this. It's a matter of faith. I take it on faith. It seems positive enough, you know. And these are the words that have come down in the church, and we use them. He says, so he says, don't ever leave your church, because you do have faith, and you really can't find anyone to talk about Jesus with outside the church. Of course, that is not strictly true. I only have to turn to my husband to see a Christian that never goes to church if he can help it. He does mow their lawn, as a matter of fact. But that's as close as he gets to going to church. As soon as he was able to escape from his Presbyterian childhood, you know, where he went with his parents, he never went again. I think that I've never known a person who had a more settled faith. He knows and calls himself a Christian, but he has no feeling whatsoever for church. So you don't have to go far to find people that don't like church or don't see any point in it. Now, as far as people that think that channeling is bad, the bishop, when I showed him my work, read it through, and it took a little time. It was, you know, very nice of him. And then he said, I don't see any harm in this. This looks good. But then he shook his finger at me, and he said, just remember that if you open this up, you know, to other people, he said, you are Christ to them. that really sunk in. And I just want to always do my best to do a good job of living and serving, because if I am Christ to somebody and they start looking into my situation, who I really am, and, you know, that kind of thing, hopefully they'll find a whole lot of positive things and a whole lot of me attempting to serve very sincerely, and, you know, never lifting up from that intention. And Jim and I renew that intention daily in our prayers in the morning. We say, we take this moment to set the intention to be your servant today, Lord. You know, it's easy to say, I love Jesus. It's easy to say, I'm his servant. But if you set your intention specifically for that day and mean it, that changes your vibration right there. And if you can be sincere about maintaining the integrity of your intention, you're doing fine. Naturally, you're going to fall. You're going to do stuff that you think is really silly. But you keep yourself tuned if you notice yourself reacting, you know, badly to somebody. And that's when, at least I start, and I know Jim starts to think about the words of St. Patrick. It's so simple. Lord, make me an instrument of your faith. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. So whatever you're listening to, it's hatred, despair, those things that are difficult, and you bring to them that vibration that you said in the morning of having the Creator move through you to be his hands, or its hands, who knows, his voice, his thoughts in the world. That's about the best that you can do. You can't do it all. You can't be perfect. If you could be perfect, there would be absolutely no reason for you to be on a third density planet. You don't need those lessons if you ace the test, you know. You just don't need them. But we all struggle to some extent, because we all have a shadow side, and certainly it pops up at the doggonedest times, and you have to retrieve yourself from saying things, you know, keeping your thoughts behind your teeth, and, you know, letting that beat go by where you move to a more spacious point of view and a more vibrationally sound point of view, where you're just looking at that person soul to soul. And that really helps to deal with the difficulties we all run into. I mean, but if somebody is mad at me or is hollering at me or is that kind of thing, I remember the words that, you know, make me blessed are those who are despitefully used by others because of your faith in Jesus. Blessed are those, you know. So you have to remember that you're getting a benediction, you're getting a blessing when this kind of catalyst comes up. It's not that easy to see it as a blessing, but, you know, with some discipline and some years in, you begin to be able to remember that more and more, you know, more times. Because there are the times that, you know, you blow it completely. But that's okay. You know, pick yourself up, as the song goes, dust yourself off, and start all over again. There's always the new day. There's always the new hour. Because when you come into the now, whenever you do that, it's a new day.
You know, now, it sounds like... Go ahead.
I was going to say, now, all the bishops, probably five bishops now, because I've gotten to be an old lady, and about nine priests. I've always diligently taken the material there and said, do you think that you can deal with this? Because if you can't, you know, I need to know that, because I don't want to go to a church where people are against me. And they look at the stuff, and to a man, they all have said, yeah, this is good stuff. I like this. You know, keep me informed. So we just send the newsletter. It comes out 4 times a year, and it's usually something I've channeled recently, so that they can keep track of what's going on with me. Am I still okay? Does the information seem good to them? I'm very fortunate to be a Cradle Episcopalian. The Anglican Church in England and around the world is known for its mystics. And so the reaction to me is that they put me down as a mystic. Oh, Carla's a mystical Christian. Yeah, she channels. But it's not a judgment. Now, my own brother was afraid that I was going to go straight to hell. And for the first 23 years that I channeled, he would get me aside and for hours and hours he'd try to talk me into giving up channeling. And I couldn't make him see that I felt that this was what Christ had called me to do as an outer work. And I certainly get beautiful thank yous from around the world every day, really, and have, you know, ever since 1981 when people started reading the Law of One material. So I know that is serving seekers that are unchurched, mostly. And that, you know, I rest in that. That's fine. But it was so bad. I finally told my brother that I would be unable to be with him anymore. I just drew a line. You know, when you're done, you're done. And I was done. I was so done. I was trying so hard to treat him the way I thought Jesus would have treated a person who was constantly on their tail. And, you know, I couldn't do it forever. I finally just broke down in tears and told him, do you know how this makes me feel? You know, look at this face. And I was crying. I don't cry very well. You know, my eyes get all swollen. My nose gets white. You know, it's just not good to see. It's, oh. And I said, you see what you do to me that when you say, I'm sorry. And I just took the next plane out, and I didn't see him again for a couple of years. And I would have been glad not to see him for a lifetime. I just didn't want that anymore. And so finally he called me, and he said he'd seen the light, and he realized that it wasn't his job to tell me what to do, that I did have free will, and he promised never to bring it up again. And he never has, I must say. That's wonderful. But I'm in the buckle of the Bible Belt, as Monica is, and man, I'd be crucified in many, many churches in this town. I would be kicked out. I'd be unacceptable completely. I mean, I don't believe in any of the stuff. I mean, when I went to Tommy's church one time, and the guy was talking about how the earth was built by Jesus 6,000 years ago, and nothing was older than that. Well, of course, there are all kinds of scientific evidence that there's a good deal more than that as far as what happened at earth. And I was thinking to myself, you know, Tommy must have lost some IQ points after college. I'm not sure. And I still don't understand it. I don't understand really why people cling so hard to a set of beliefs that basically do not seem relevant to me. But they do. And I've come to think that the reason is that some people just want to know what's right and what's wrong. They don't want any gray. They want white and black. This is right. This is wrong. And it comforts them to feel that they are in the in crowd, that they know what's going on, and they can tell it to you. So, you know, this varies, of course, from Protestant church to Protestant church, you know, to Catholic church. Every sect has its own belief system, and they don't all agree. So, you know, the great effort of many churchmen is to try to unite the church, but it's very difficult to do that, and try to bring it up into a more spacious point of view. When I was a child, women were not allowed in the chancel as readers or acolytes or carrying the cross or any of that. No women, no girls. You couldn't even have girls in the choir. And as I grew up, you know, decade by decade, this loosened up and then it fell away. And now women are very, very active in chancel ministries, and we have many woman ministers. So, you know, it's a change for the better. But there will always be outrageously ranking, nasty, mean, petty arguments from people that want to tell you what's right from a religious point of view. And if you don't believe exactly like they do, well, you know, you're going to hell. It's a very difficult benediction, but you just have to say, well, thank you. Thank you for this, and I'll work with it.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I can definitely relate. I've got my share of experiences with those kind of churches. And, yeah, not easy to deal with at all. Okay, did you have any, I guess you don't have anything to add to that, Jim, since you're not a churchgoer, huh?
No, they all appreciate the way I cut the grass, and they're very gracious.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, the next question is from Casey Gal. I'm a relative newbie to this material. How am I supposed to know if I am truly moving towards Green Ray or am fooling myself? I've been very much interested in healthy living and eating most of my life. Does that make me self-oriented? Is it negative to try to care for one's own body as well as possible, to eat well, exercise, and meditate? Also, when one becomes aware that we cannot really harm another without harming ourselves or help another without helping ourselves, then the line between self and other is blurred. So how is this sorted out? In other words, it is impossible to perform a really selfless act if you know that every time you help someone else, you're really helping yourself. This is from Casey Gal.
Okay. There are several thoughts in there. So let me take them one at a time. Number one, this is a very common question for a newbie. I'm so glad to be talking to you, Casey Gal. Thank you so much for writing in. I really appreciate these thoughts. You speak for many in all of these concerns. So you don't know if you are truly moving towards Green Ray or if you're fooling yourself. All you can do is attempt to find the deepest sincerity and authenticity of yourself and move from that. And that's really all you can do. As you become less of a newbie, you become more sophisticated simply by the repetition of information, by the repetition of times that you meditate, by, you know, working with this through the years, things open up more and that worry goes away. But it's so common to want to check your oil, you know, how am I doing? And it's so punishing to do that, because you can't know how you're doing. All you can do is intend to do well. Now, the beautiful thing about that is that what matters to the time-space part of you, to the consciousness part of you, to the infinitely eternal part of you, is that intention. Set your intention. Set it every day. Don't assume that because you said it once, it's done. It's not done. It's one day at a time. And sometimes one moment at a time when things get really tough. You need to renew that intention. Now, you know, we I remember when roller skating was real popular when I was a teenager back in the 50s. And I tried and tried to become a good roller skater, but all I could do was go forward, and I could lean a little bit, and that would bring me to the sidebar, and I'd run into the sidebar and stop. That's all the better that I ever got at roller skating. I have no knack for it whatsoever, which surprised me because I'm a dancer, but I don't know. There was something about it that I just didn't get. And it was so disappointing to me because everybody was having so much fun, and here I was. Best I could do is just run into the pop stand and get a pop and sit down and drink it. Glad that I hadn't, you know, fallen down or otherwise disgraced myself. We can't always do as well as the other people around us are doing. We can't do some of the same things that other people are doing, and there's no sense even in comparing one day to another. You need only to do your best and to remember that this is the present moment. This is a powerful moment. And the more deeply that you set that intention, the more your vibration will be lifted towards that of the Creator, which is infinite and all-compassionate love. Now, can you have all-compassionate love all the time? Case in point, I have a little kitty cat. He's 16 now, and he has driven me crazy for every single year. He wants to lick. He wants to lick and lick and lick. If you pat him and try to get him to, you know, get sleepy and get over it and get tired of it and relax, there's no end to it. You can't do it. You just have to put him away when you get tired of it. Some people, it bothers some people. It especially bothers me, I think, because he loves me so much and he wants so much to lick me. And when he was a little kitten, you know, it was charming. But 16 years later, I've had it, you know, with the licking. Feels like there's a wet Kleenex attached to me somewhere. And it's just no fun at all. Yuck. And I'll try to settle him down, and he won't settle. So the long history of putting him down, you know, and saying, do something else, kid, because I just can't deal with that. So you are always going to be seeing yourself in the mirror and seeing faults. Okay. We have faults. That's okay. Don't let that put you into any kind of despair. Don't judge yourself. Never judge yourself. Just try to do your best at all times. And when you find you're not doing your best, well, this is a good time to sit down and work with that. Why am I feeling this way? Why, when I want to be a good guy, am I just ready to, you know, cut that person's throat? You know, this is in a deep and abiding passion at this point. You know, somebody you work with that you just cannot hack it with, something like that. It prepares you for a lifetime of not judging others. But first, you have to learn not to judge yourself. So when you're attempting to clear your energy centers and you're moving towards the open heart, do it in faith. Maybe you don't understand everything about it, but do it in faith. You're going to get there. And, you know, when you appreciate yourself for having that intention, you're basically already there. You really need to fall in love with yourself and deal with yourself in a way, the way of a lover. Give yourself little treats. Encourage yourself. Give yourself hugs and pats. And if you've got a child in there that did not get that kind of thing, well, help that person too. Jim, what do you got to say?
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. You need to be able to accept what you're doing as the very best that you can do. and not try to take your spiritual temperature, because none of us is wise enough to be able to do that. And we really need to just, like you said, give our best effort and have faith that we're giving our best effort. And it's your intentions, really, in this third density illusion that matter the most, because, as Ross said, this is not the density of understanding. We don't see clearly enough to be able to discern what is an action that is more helpful than another action. As long as our intentions are there, that's what's really important. We can have some control over our intentions. We can intend to do our best. We can intend to grow. We can intend to love and to serve. So I would suggest that we just look at our intentions and try to magnify those and not worry about whether we've been successful on the metaphysical level, because we can't know that here.
Okay. Second question, if we're done with that first one. Monica, you got anything?
I do have one more quick question. We just have a few minutes left on another topic. Did you mean another question on that topic? Or
yeah.
You ready for the next one?
Okay. I'm ready for the next one.
Okay. I'm going to go with a short...
How many minutes do I have?
About 8 minutes.
8 minutes. Okay, well,
maybe,
give me a wave and a warning.
Okay. Maybe 6 or 7 to allow a little time to, but
oh.
You know, eight max. Okay,
well, I think I can do that.
Well, this is a short one. This is actually for me. I have a question about colors, and you know how we all have our favorite colors, and some colors we don't like as much as others. What does it mean if we like a certain color? Does it mean that that ray is very open, thus attracting us to that color, or is it the opposite, that we lack that color, so we're attracted to it in order to balance it? For example, let's say a person loves blue but really dislikes orange. Should they make a point to wear more orange even though they don't like it, because they actually need it? And should they avoid the blue since they already like the blue? Or should they go ahead and flow with it and immerse themselves in the blue that they like and avoid the orange that they don't like? And if they don't like orange, does that indicate a blockage in orange ray?
Oh, okay. That doesn't at all suggest a blockage. The way you vibrate probably has more to do with the colors that you like. I would relate them to the chakras. You know, they come in order: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And different people are at different places and are functioning largely from a place that it could be said to be red ray, orange ray, and so forth. It basically, a person who is wanting to get up and go, energy-wise, is probably working with the lower chakras and working with relationships. The work not done yet, where there's a piece there. I remember liking yellow and orange, the two together, and my grandmother made a bedspread and curtains out of material she'd found that had yellow and orange in it. And I just loved it. Hang on a minute. Don't like it so much. Hang on a minute. Got to get something else, which my father said, that's a perfectly good bedspread and curtains, and you're not getting anything else. So as I, you know, matured, I was more fond of the blue, indigo, violet, that range there, and green. I think that these days I like all the colors, so I don't think that that indicates that I'm using all the colors or anything particular about me. It's just a preference. There really is a meaning to color. Each of the colors has a life of its own. True color green, you know, is a vibration that we are seeking in this incarnation. We are vibrating yellow ray, and we have begun to master yellow ray and we're seeking that open heart. And so we find those colors more attractive to us, perhaps. But I think there comes a time when you have to realize that a lot of things go into choosing your favorite colors that are not spiritual, per se. You might, for instance, enjoy the feeling that you get when you have an all-white apartment and then you sprinkle it with all kinds of colorful pillows and stuff, you know, to make your state. Or, you know, things like that where you're playing with all of the colors and, so, you know, you pretty much claimed all of them. So I think there is a tendency there to figure, well, if I'm really, if my favorite color is blue, then probably I'm drawn to a place where the truth is known and that it is shared in total compassionate love. That's what Blu-ray is about. It's good not to immerse yourself totally in any one color, I think, because you need to, as you grow, you need to become a full whole person, not just focusing on your work in the upper chakras, but celebrating that work that continues until the day we die on the lower chakras as well. I am just as needy for starting at red ray when I'm looking at what thoughts I had that day as I was 50 years ago. Probably I don't stay in that ray long, but that I feel comfortable with it is really good because, well, for instance, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the lower chakras of red, orange, and yellow are the color scheme in almost all fast food joints. And what that suggests is that energy of red ray that makes you eat fast and get going, and they want you to do that. They want you to eat fast and free up the chair for somebody else. That's what fast food is all about. And if you go to a more expensive restaurant, one that is attempting to be more elegant and studied, you might find that it's all been beiged out and there's not a lot of color, but it's just elegance, you know, like the Art Deco style. So much black and white in that, and shades of earth tones. But you can just take that meaning, the color meaning so far, and then it becomes kind of ridiculous, Monica.
Well, do you think if someone actually dislikes a color that they should just, you know, leave it at that and avoid that color because they don't like it, or does that mean they really need it and
they should make
a point to get that color?
I think that if you dislike, say you dislike orange, is that the one that you disliked?
No, I was just using that as an example. I've actually changed colors through the...
A lot, yeah, right. I think it's healthy to do that. But
I did years ago, so I was just asking a gent. I just kind of tossed that out as an example.
Yeah, but I think that it is an indication that where to look. So you say, okay, well, what is orange? What's the orange ray about? Well, the orange ray is the ray of plant life and animal life that doesn't have spirit. The dance is unending in that ray, and truth is known in that ray, but is not known by the self. There's no selfhood. There's just a pool, shall we say, of genetic essence. And out of that pool come the various entities. And what you're doing when you take one of these entities and, you know, for a pet, say you take a cat from the pond and pound and you just love it and pat it and it's your kitty cat and, you know, it begins to love you. It's being invested. so that maybe its next incarnation is ready to become a human and ready for those lessons of love, because it's been invested by someone loving it and someone to love.
You still there, Carla?
I am.
Oh,
I was,
okay.
I was done.
Oh, okay.
Got any thoughts?
All right.
No.
Okay, we are actually out of time. And
okay.
All right. Well, you guys have a great party next week and have fun. And I know it's going to be a lot of love and lighting up all of Louisville next week. So empower the whole city with all the love vibrations next week. So
yeah.
You have a wonderful time.
And I'd like just a note. I'd like to let Casey Grill know that I am very happy to answer the rest of her questions next week, week after next.
Okay, we will be back on Friday, September 7th at 8 o'clock Eastern. You've been listening to LL Research's In the Now with Carla L. Reichert and Jim McCarty. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit llresearch.org and bringforth.org. That's bring, the number 4, th.org. And we'll be back here in 2 weeks on September 7th, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern.